the webinar process. So our first speaker is Sarah Bauer. She's the Federal Technology Transfer Act Coordinator at the EPA. She's had over 10 years of experience in technology transfer issues. She has chaired the Education and Training Committee of the Federal Laboratory Consortium for Technology Transfer for the past 8 years. Previously, she was a Communications Director in the Office of Research and Development. Throughout her 24-plus years at EPA, she has held various positions on both ORD and the former Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, which is now called the Office of Land and Emergency Management, or OLEM. And our second speaker is Laura Scalise. She is a patent attorney for the EPA. Since 2001, she has coordinated the patenting of dozens of EPA inventions and negotiates the licenses that bring in the royalties to those laboratories that patent. She also reviews cooperative research and development agreements, or CRADAs, and other research agreements for the purpose of preserving the agency's intellectual property rights. And before we move on, we would like to pass it off to our colleague, Jeff Heimerman. He is from the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. And he wanted to say a few words, and I'll just say that Jeff attended the Superfund SRP annual meeting in Puerto Rico this year, and he not only gave a presentation for one of the days of the main meeting, but he also participated in the technology transfer breakout group that the Research Translation and Community Engagement Corps had prior to the SRP annual meeting. And I think we can thank Jeff for his inspiration related to that opportunity to interact with the grantees during that technology transfer discussion. So I'm gonna pass it off to Jeff, and I think he wanted to say a few words before introducing Sarah.
Thank you, Heather. Again, this is Jeff Heimerman in the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. And I just wanted to take a really brief moment to give this some context. And between the event down in San Juan and just other conversations with various SRP grantees, it became pretty clear to me that while you're funded through NIEHS for your grants, at some point in the continuum of your research or technology development, you want to partner with EPA. So today's program is, in my mind, kind of a road leveling exercise to help everyone understand the formal mechanisms to enter into cooperative research and development with EPA, and hopefully help down the road, if you're interested in that, to do air traffic control and help you find the right places. So I hope this is of value to you today, and I look forward to Sarah and Laura's presentation and to your comments at the end of it. So thank you very much, and I will pass the torch to Sarah Bauer. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Heather, for the introduction and also all of the work that went behind setting this up for folks. So a big thank you to the audience for being here and for all of the key players, including Sarah and Kevin and Michelle, et cetera. So again, I'm Sarah Bauer, and I'm the lead for the Tech Transfer Program here at EPA, and I'm going to go over a little bit about what the program is and what Tech Transfer is. A little bit about who we are and the offices that may be of interest to you, the process, some of the agreements that we have, and then I'll pass it off to Laura to talk about more of the IP, intellectual property, and patenting side of things. There will be an opportunity for questions, so let's just get started. Again, Sarah Bauer and Laura Scalise, we've gone over that in the introduction. So I think first off, what we're going to do is just give a brief definition of tech transfer and then give you some interesting examples of opportunities where folks have come to us to further collaborate on some of the research projects that they're currently working on. Then we're going to give you an overview of what EPA's capabilities are for collaborative research, what our labs and program offices do, how you actually can work with us. As Jeff mentioned, the vehicles that are available to you, the mechanisms and the process that you have to follow through. There's also another opportunity, which is a user facility where you can come in and use a piece of our equipment or our facility. It doesn't really involve any collaboration, but it's kind of like on a rental basis. And then we'll talk about intellectual property identification. What is it? Why do you need to know about it? And how it's managed. So what exactly is tech transfer? Technology transfer is something that is defined differently everywhere you go. For the sake of the FTTA program here at EPA, it's really taking the existing federal knowledge, our facilities, our capabilities, what we have, and we want to be able to fulfill public and private needs. And we do this through collaborative research between federal and non-federal scientists. So most of the agreements I'm going to talk about today are between federal and non-federal parties. And then the technologies that are developed by the federal government are transferred to the private, pardon me, or public parties for further development and or commercialization. And I'll go into that a little bit more later. It can also be technologies that are developed in the private sector brought into us. Why do we do this? Well, first of all, it's mandated by law. We are required to provide the opportunity for others to partner with us through collaborative opportunities. We also need to have a vehicle in place for us, the federal government, to transfer property, whether that property is coming into us or it's something we're giving away. So we need to have something that says that we can actually give something away or receive something at no cost. It protects federal intellectual property, and again, Laura will be touching on that a bit more later. And then it allows for us to collaborate with partners from the private sector, so you really have the chance to partner with the research scientists at the federal government, and as well, federal scientists have an opportunity to collaborate with their peers in the private sector. I think some of you are probably with universities, and most universities have technology transfer offices, so you may want to reach out to them after this seminar to just talk to them and find out what some of the processes are and the opportunities that are available. And I should say, when I talk about the EPA's FTTA program, Federal Technology Transfer Act program, this is a program that exists in several agencies across the federal government. So the research, pardon me, the agencies that perform research have a research budget, have S&T dollars. I would say there are about 17, I don't know that I have the last count, 17 of these agencies that participate in this type of effort. And the Department of Commerce, NIST, is the agency that has the lead for the federal government. Some of the benefits that we have for collaboration is that, as I mentioned, we get to collaborate with our peers, both inside and outside of the government. We can leverage the research dollars on both sides. We can further the research and development that's being done on a certain topic or in a certain field. We hope that we come up with improved and cost-effective technology development. We can license some of these new technologies to the companies that we collaborate with. We get a better return on our investment. And we get the, in our case, environmental technology into the field quickly. And these are just some of the benefits that exist for not only the federal laboratories and the private sector, but also the general public, our taxpayer. We do want to be mindful of that. The EPA's FTTA program has a small staff. We have myself, we have Kathleen Graham, who also leads this program with me, and she's located out in Denver, Colorado. And we have Connie Ng, who is new to us, who's working on our licensing side of the house, patenting and licensing side. And we also have Rochelle Perry, who does some of our administrative tasks. And then we collaborate very, very closely with our Office of General Counsel, and that's Laura Scalise. We also have Jeff Cooper, Randall Cherry, who was out of town today, and Scott Albright. So there's a group of us together that manage this, and we really look at the partnerships that we have for collaborative research. We help identify what the proper vehicle would be and what's an appropriate topic. Again, the intellectual property identification and protection, any EPA inventions or sometimes EPA co-inventions, can process, we can start the patenting process, and then licensing of those EPA or EPA joint patents. And let me just stop and say that every licensing opportunity is really handled on a case-by-case basis, and we work very closely with, if it's a joint patent, with the joint inventor's entity, whether it's a university or a business, et cetera. We also help the EPA researchers and potential partners look at the ideas that they have and see if it's actually something that would be suitable for the FTTA program for the vehicles that we have available that we're going to be talking about in a second. So one of the first examples that we have to let you know how this works, and let me just say that most of the opportunities that we have, folks do come into us, but they don't always bring technologies into us. But there is an opportunity for us to take an EPA technology and further develop it with the private sector, or take something from the private sector, such as our audience group today would have, and bring it into the agency for further development or further research. We can also enter into an agreement to come up with some joint effort, some joint project, or a joint improvement. So Solvay Chemical is our first example. And EPA was interested in developing an environmentally friendly way to treat water that was an alternative to chlorine. So any chlorine-based disinfectant produces the toxins, and we were trying to reduce the toxic disinfectant byproducts. So one of our laboratories, our National Risk Management Research Laboratory, entered into a creative with Solvay, and they developed a process producing parasitic acid, and that was far more viable and safer than chlorine for the disinfection of the water. So the CRADA was actually motivated by not only the U.S., but the worldwide requirement for having safer and greener alternative to disinfectants, such as the PAA was, and for the water and for the wastewater treatment. And the reduction in the chlorinated byproducts really did add to improving public health. So through this collaboration, EPA and Solvay co-developed other processes, and they field tested the company's parasitic acid. Zaps was a small company that we worked with to collaborate on their water quality measurement technology. And EPA, they had a monitor that had, could I monitor several parameters that was run through the water, and EPA provided enhancements to their system for running this through the water. And the final patented device continually monitors water, and it says here, in quote, spectrophotometrically by measuring many optical parameters in an inline online system, which also compensates for normal fluid changes while detecting abnormalities. I know it's a quote, I'm reading it, I apologize. Because of this co-development together, we were able to exclusively license our rights to Zaps for commercialization. So Zaps does have an exclusive license, which isn't something that we normally give out, but if there is a co-inventor, we're able to do that, and they are now commercializing that technology. This is really small print, I'm sorry, but it's an interesting story. So we had a need to measure quickly in real time the fecal contamination at water sites. And we evaluated this in conjunction with some studies that showed that there was a relationship between water quality that was measured by this qPCR test and swimming related illnesses. So the bottom line is that this was really a great improvement over how we study this later, but the equipment that we had was bulky and couldn't give us real time. So the qPCR instruments that were available, because they were too large, we couldn't take them to the beaches, and that was like one of the primary spots where we were doing these, where we needed to do the analysis. So there was a genetic identification detection instrument that was developed by Dr. Chang at the University of Notre Dame, and that had the potential to have the portability that we needed and did not require the fluorescent reporter molecules that was required for the qPCR. So EPA and FCube entered into a CRADA, and Notre Dame had an agreement with the F-cubed company, which is how we reached through to Notre Dame, to determine whether or not this technology could produce the results that were equivalent to those that we were getting using the current qPCR method. And we're hoping that this, the CRADA is still underway. We're hoping that this does, in fact, prove to be true and that the advantages will be not only greater speed but less expense, and then there's no need for the potentially toxic reporter molecules. and Kellogg Foundation in Calhoun County. We were approached by the Kellogg Foundation and the Calhoun County Public Health Department to look at lead levels in schools in child care facilities in Battle Creek, Michigan. So through a CRADA, we had samples provided to us by the Public Health Department, and EPA was able to buy testing equipment through funds that Kellogg supplied. This was a three-way CRADA, and we had an EPA testing event to look at the lead levels and to provide some kind of an action that would help reduce the children's exposure to lead from these very vulnerable child care facilities and schools. Let's stop there and see if we have any questions on anything I've covered so far. The FTTA program can be very, very broad and very diverse and cover a lot of things, so it may be confusing. So I'll stop and see if there are any questions.
Thanks, Sarah. And if anyone has any questions, you're welcome to submit them. You're welcome to submit your questions at any point in the time. At this moment, we don't have any questions that have come through. So if you'd like to keep going, that would be great.
Perfect. Thank you. All right, let me go over our national research program. So EPA has a focus for our research through national research programs. And I don't want to go into this too much in depth, but what I've done is I've included the web address where you can go in and find out more information about these. We also have laboratories both in our Office of Research and Development and also in our program offices and our regional offices. And these national research programs basically drive the research that we're doing. So the first focus is on air, climate, and energy. We commonly call it the ACE program. And we just provide the science to develop and implement the National Ambient Air Quality Standards under the Clean Air Act. And we're looking at, obviously, innovative approaches to combating all of the climate change conditions and energy production issues. The next is chemical safety for sustainability. And here we are looking at information and methods that are needed to make better informed and more timely decisions about the chemicals that have potential risks for human health and the environment. We have safe and sustainable water resources, which deals with all water issues. It supports innovative scientific and technological solutions for clean air, for equitable supplies of water, for ecosystems. The Sustainable and Healthy Communities conducts research to help communities make better decisions for a healthy society, and we are trying to create the tools that those communities may need. The Human Health Risk Assessment Research Program identifies and evaluates and synthesizes and integrates scientific information on individual chemicals and chemical mixtures. And finally, our Homeland Security helps to build system-based solutions and provide technical support to increase EPA's capability to achieve Homeland Security responsibilities. We do have program offices, and the first one I have on the list is the Office of Land and Emergency Management, of which Jeff is a member of, and a lot of the Superfund work, most of the Superfund work is done there. So we've got hazardous waste management, underground storage tank, brownfields, accidental oil and chemical release programs. The next is the Office of Water, which ensures drinking water is safe, that there are healthy ecosystems, that oceans and watersheds are restored and maintained, and all of these in order to help not only protect human health, but also the aquatic wildlife. And the Office of Air and Radiation, which develops all of our national programs and policies and regulations for controlling air pollution and radiation exposure. And it is concerned not only with pollution prevention and energy efficiency, but also air quality, industrial air pollution, pollution from vehicles and engines, radon, et cetera. And we do have our vehicle and fuel emission laboratory in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And finally, we have our ORD labs and research centers. And these are all of the main laboratories within the Office of Research and Development. So I have a link to ORD under the main title, and then a link to all of our labs underneath. But the risk management lab really looks at, it's more of our engineering lab, so it looks at the characterization and the prevention and control of pollution, land resources, water, and also remediation for contaminated soils, groundwater, and the protection of public health. So they're kind of like the engineering lab for all of these areas. The National Exposure Research Laboratory looks at innovations in exposure science, including the tools necessary to quantify exposure. The Homeland Security Research Center looks at homeland security issues, whether it's rapid response or early detection. Our National Health and Environmental Effects Research Laboratory looks at the effects of contaminants and other stressors, environmental stressors, on human health and the ecosystem. And our National Center for Computational Toxicology coordinates the Computational Toxicology Research Program, and they also have the CompTox database. So that's a really fast look at what these are, but you can get far more information on the program offices, the laboratories, and our research programs at the links that we have. And I also have included at the end of the presentation one page, or I guess it's a couple pages actually, of all these links in one area. The Center for Environmental Research and the Center for Environmental Assessment are two more centers that we have. We don't really do a lot of collaborative agreements with these two centers. That doesn't mean we couldn't. We certainly can, but we certainly, the other laboratories come to us far more than these do. But the Center for Environmental Research looks at our SBIR program, our STAR grants, and other grant opportunities, our pollution prevention, people, prosperity, and planet. And then the National Center for Environmental Assessment provides guidance on how pollutants could impact human health and the environment. And they set up all of the assessments and guidelines. Any questions on EPA's capabilities?
Sarah, there haven't been any questions submitted.
Okay, thank you. All right, let's get into the meat of how you work with us. As I mentioned, cooperative research and development agreements are our most popular vehicle, and these are commonly referred to as CRADAs, and many times the FTTA program is called the CRADA program, even though we deal with much more than just CRADAs. Under a CRADA, EPA can enter into an agreement with an outside party, and that can be just about anybody. So it can be industry, academia, nonprofits, trade associations, foreign governments, foreign universities, individuals. And the whole goal is to perform research and or development, and it must be collaborative, and it must be consistent with the mission of the laboratory or office. So if an outside partner does come to us and wants to collaborate with us and feels that there's a specific laboratory that would be the perfect fit, we have to be sure that it is within that mission of the laboratory and that there are the resources, staff, et cetera, to be able to do that. Under these agreements, EPA can provide personnel services, facilities, equipment, resources, expertise, but no money. We do not give out money under the FTTA program. We are not allowed to give money out. However, having said that, a non-federal party can provide all of those same in-kind resources, and they can also provide funds to us. So we can take money in. Usually that money helps to buy supplies for the research that we might not have, or to go into a contract that we have for a contractor that is performing some of those services for us. Every CRADA that we have doesn't necessarily have to have funds come in, but they all have to have the collaborative in-kind match. There are other types of partnerships, as I mentioned. CRADAs obviously are the main one, and this is where we usually take a technology or even an idea that's developed in the private sector that we can jointly improve on between EPA and the partner, or we can take a technology developed by EPA and jointly improve it, or we may co-develop something, and I think I mentioned that earlier. We also have what's called a material transfer agreement, and this is where we can either provide or receive research materials from a partner organization, but we are not allowed to provide any funding. So, for example, if you have some materials that are left over that you want to give to the federal government, we will happily receive them using one of these material transfer agreements. If there is a shipping fee or a processing fee or a fee for the materials themselves, we cannot handle that under a material transfer agreement. We would have to go through procurement for that. And a materials CRADA, or an M-CRADA, is a hybrid of the two. So it's It's kind of like having a material transfer agreement, but with a little bit more. So you want to exchange materials. Maybe you want to collaborate a little bit and see how you each performed using a certain assay, or you want to see how certain materials fare under certain conditions. And then there might be some tweaking back and forth, a report writing, and then maybe a joint paper is published. So that's the type of thing where we could do a materials CRADA. And that just kind of covers, you know, chain of custody and responsibilities of who's doing what. These are usually very, very simple and have no complications, meaning that there's no funding, no cash coming into us, and there's absolutely no intellectual property that's anticipated to come out of the effort. And they're usually a year or less. So they're very, very simple. Any questions on the agreement so far?
Sarah, there have not been any questions coming in, but I think
okay.
It would be really interesting to know among our grantees, and they're welcome to use the Q&A pod. I think it would be really interesting to know if anyone has had any experiences with these types of agreements. It might give us a nice basis for conversation during the more open question and answer period. So I would encourage those of you who are on, if any of those ring a bell, if these are agreements you've been involved in, please share and let us know. I think Sarah Mishmandani said we can even have some time for you to talk about your experiences. So I would encourage you to be thinking about that. And in the meantime, with my talking, we did get a couple questions coming in. So I will, Sarah, go ahead and ask you these questions. How do we find out what material and equipment may be available? Where do we request these? Is the material and equipment transfer for EPA different than that for the federal government?
Let me just say that our... Yes and no. First of all, EPA is one of the 17 or 18 federal agencies that does do Federal Technology Transfer Act. And so all of these agencies do CRADAs and MCRADAs and material transfer agreements. However, having said that, EPA is a very, very conservative agency. We're a regulatory agency, so we don't necessarily have the authorities that other agencies have. So, for example, our boilerplate might be a little different than some of the other boilerplates just because of the authorities they have. And a good example of that is NASA. NASA has the Space Act. So because of the Space Act, they are allowed to provide funding under a CRADA. And so working with the NIH, they might have a little bit of a different form of an agreement because of the research that they do in the medical area and how they patent and license the medical inventions that they come up with. So as far as the federal government is concerned, yes, we all do it. And the boilerplates are all pretty similar, but they're not all exactly the same. And I'm sorry, Heather, what was the first part of that question?
The first part of the question, which I think you'll be getting to maybe a little bit later, but how do we find out about the material and equipment that may be available? And where do we request these? So I think you were going to talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah, I think that the best thing to do if you're looking for a specific piece of equipment or material is to look at the description of the laboratories that I have up and the work that they may do and see first if there's anything that would refer you to the type of need that you have, if it would address that need. You can also, at the end of this presentation, I have a contact sheet, so you can call any one of us and we'd be happy to help you. And one other thing that I do want to mention is that the Federal Laboratory Consortium, all of these federal agencies are members of the Federal Lab Consortium. And the Federal Lab Consortium was created to assist federal laboratories in all of their tech transfer efforts. And there is a technology locator service on the FLC website. And that, I don't know, I'm pretty sure I have a link to the FLC at the end. It's federallabs.org. Don't do FLC because I think that's a church somewhere in the United States. I'm not sure. But they do have an opportunity for you to reach out, and they will try and go out and get that information for you.
This is Jeff. May I ask a question related, possibly? Materials could include groundwater, dirty soil, would it not?
Yes, absolutely. Materials can be data, it can be testing equipment, it can be any of that. And if you have any questions, you can certainly call us and ask, is this an appropriate material? I think there was something on a question that came in on data analysis too. So we certainly can, I mean, until we know a little bit more about it, we have included data as a transfer element.
Right. So the question was, can there be an agreement between EPA and an outside, example, academic, to do analysis? And I wonder if this might also mean, like, chemical, to do data analysis. No, you're right. That's what they said.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of an example. Laura, I don't know. Can you think of an example where we did, I mean, there's usually data analysis to a lot of the collaborations that we do, so.
One that was just specifically, data analysis is not coming to mind, but data analysis goes along with, analyzing samples or collecting, monitoring data and stuff like that. So, but I can't think of anything that was just straight
up. Yeah,
data.
I can't think of anything with CompTox with the database. Can you? I know that they, that might be a little different. But I think that, if there's, we can certainly talk to you more in depth about what it is that you're trying to do and who you want to work with. But we have worked with academic institutions quite a bit, both in material transfer agreements and in CRADAs, both here and internationally. Any other questions?
Great. And then even just to follow up with your comments and Jeff's comments, it is also possible to be working informally with EPA and getting groundwater or dirty soil. It's not required that every time there's an exchange that a CRADA would be involved or a formal transfer. I mean, apart from, material transfer processes that are, required.
If there is, if it's just transferring, water samples back and forth, that can just be a material transfer agreement. And the reason that we have to do these is because the government is not allowed to receive anything for free without a vehicle that says it. And likewise, we are not allowed to give away government property without having a vehicle that says, okay, it's okay to give this away. It's I know it can sound crazy sometimes, but the fact of the matter is, if there's a piece of equipment that belongs to EPA and they no longer need it anymore, while it would be nice to just give it away, it's government property, so we need to have an authority to do that. So the material transfer agreement, it can be pretty simple. It just allows for that. And that also, covers the whole, like I mentioned, chain of custody, who's going to send it, what happens if it gets lost in the mail, what happens if it gets damaged, what happens when you're finished using it, does it get returned, et cetera.
Got it. Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. Anything else?
I think we're done. Why don't we move on, and we'll encourage people to, again, submit questions. And if you have had experiences with any of these types of agreements that you'd want to share, please, mention that in your question and answer box. All right, Sarah, back
And
to
I'm
you.
Glad you. Thank you, Heather. And I'm glad you mentioned that because it's really helpful for me to find out if anybody in the audience does have familiarity with any tech transfer opportunities that they've had or if they know what a CRADA is. But I'm just assuming that folks probably don't. So this is a pretty basic briefing. And as I mentioned, you'll probably have questions later. And please don't hesitate to pick up the phone or send us an email. All right, let's go on to additional tech transfer agreements. The first one is licensing, and I mentioned this a little bit before, but this is where we have technologies that are developed here in EPA and are patented. We can transfer that to a partner through a license agreement, and they can either further develop it or commercialize it. And many times we will have a joint invention, and we look at the whole patenting process with the partner. We decide if we do want to go forward with patenting, who's going to be filing the patent applications, who's going to take up that cost, and then we can exclusively license to our partner. And Laura will go into this a little bit more later, but this is the one instance where we can offer an exclusive license to that partner for commercialization. Usually the royalties that are received under the license will go back to reimburse whoever paid the patenting fees initially. But that all, as I mentioned, all of these are negotiated on an individual basis. There's a standard boilerplate that we work from, but they really are tailor-made. Non-disclosure agreements are something that we really try to recommend as often as possible. And these just allow for more in-depth discussions prior to entering into an agreement with us. This allows for, you know, freedom of discussion in case something might come up in the discussion that would involve something that could be sensitive in nature, or maybe initially it's just one party who thinks they're bringing something sensitive to the table when, in fact, once discussion takes place, both parties have sensitive information. Once the CRADA is signed, the confidentiality is covered, so you don't need the disclosure agreement anymore. But if to have an initial discussion, if you feel something is sensitive, might be a good idea to enter into. It's not required for everything. And then the user facility agreement is what I mentioned before. It just allows a non-federal entity to use or to rent our equipment. And that is, when we get a request in for that, we usually refer them to our laboratories because our laboratories have a separate office that manages all of the property. MOUs and IAs I wanted to put in here. We don't really cover them under our FTTA agreements, but our branch chief, Patty Palmer, does review the MOUs and the IAs that come in. And a memorandum of understanding is really an unfunded agreement between ORD and another entity. It's not binding, although there could be some binding clauses in it, such as in, intellectual property rights or proprietary information. And likewise, an interagency agreement is just an opportunity to provide or receive funding from one federal agency to another for goods or services. So I just put them here more for clarification and definition, just because I didn't want folks thinking that an MOU was the same thing as a CRADA. It's not. Proprietary information. So information that comes to us that's proprietary is treated as CBI. And it's treated as CBI for as long as it's CBI. So the cooperator CBI may be exempt from release under a FOIA. And I say may because you never can say always will and shall, depending on what's going on. But we really do protect it under the CBI, and it is exempt. Information that's generated under a CRADA, so if you already have the CRADA established and something proprietary or sensitive pops up, can be exempted from disclosure under FOIA for up to 5 years after the research is completed. And this allows for you to complete the research, to get all the raw data finalized, to get, if you're going to be publishing, to get that set, if you're going to be patenting, to be able to file for the patent application. And that's our last bullet. Information that's created by the lab can be exempted from a disclosure until we have filed a patent application. And a rule of thumb is, and Laura will get into this, always, always, always file for a patent application before you publish because of disclosure. But Laura will go into that more with the intellectual property discussion. This is just a schematic of the partnering process. So the EPA and the research come together and they say, hey, I'd like to work on this. It's a great idea. So the partnership is formed usually through a CRADA, but it could be an MCRADA. The joint research is conducted. Both parties have contributed in-kind resources. They're both going to be taking part in this. And then sometimes there's a new technology that is patentable. And if that is the case, then a patent application is prepared and the technology is licensed and the product is then in the marketplace ready for use. And that also brings in royalties, and the royalties are shared by all inventors. So if it's a joint invention, both the external party and the EPA researcher would share in the royalties. This is a shot of our FTTA website, and this you will have a link to at the end of the presentation as well. And you can basically see that we talk about what our overall program is over here, some of the technologies that we have available for licensing. This is a list of our patents, how you work with us, the type of partnerships that we have, and some of our success stories. And if you go over on the right, there's some information here on the FLC. I think there's a link to our fact sheets. There is down here the templates that we use, so you can get an idea what a CRADA looks like and what an MTA looks like, and any other related information that might pop up. So there's an SBIR, and then there's our Cincinnati cluster, our innovation technology cluster, et cetera. So this is a shot of the FTTA site that you'll get. And questions?
Sarah, somebody did ask, who pays for the processing of the patent?
If it's an EPA patent, obviously EPA will pay for it. And if it's a joint invention, many times the partner organization will pay for it because they have the capabilities and they have the marketing opportunities that will be coming up. And when they commercialize it, they'll be able to reimburse immediately with the royalties. That's not always the case, and it's, you know, it's on a case-by-case basis. So if we have a partner that comes in and there's an interest in patenting, it may be that the lab files the patent application.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
At this time, we don't have any other questions. If you'd like to continue.
Okay. I will. Thank you. And I'm going to now turn it over to Laura Scalise, who is our patent attorney here at EPA. Laura?
Okay, folks. Sarah, can you please pass the ball to me?
I'm muted. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm in the process of doing that right now.
All right. Okay, so
there,
I
there, you should have it. You should have it.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Okay. I'm Laura Scalise. I'm a patent attorney for the agency. I've been doing it since 2001. What is intellectual property? It's sensitive information that belongs to the creator, a person, or an organization. Everyone has a responsibility to recognize and protect intellectual property, especially our government, especially our intellectual property if we're collaborating with you. But, you know, keep in mind your own. IP is protected for the purposes of patenting, publishing, further research. The key word here is protecting. Non-EPA employees or collaborators or grantees working with EPA researchers must have a non-disclosure agreement in place and permission to work with EPA sensitive information. And this is all for the purposes of, you know, keeping confidential, like Sarah said, until, you know, we're ready to either patent or publish. Okay, a lot of software comes up often, you know, is software patentable? It is copyrightable, but it's getting more difficult to patent software in light of Alice Corp, which Alice Corp Property Limited versus CLS Bank International. It was a 2014 case that came on the heels of Bilski. The takeaway from Alice is just because you're implementing an abstract idea with a computer doesn't turn that abstract idea into an actual patentable invention. And this comes under 35 U.S.C. 101. I mean, it's the first step in whether or not you have something that's patentable. Is it something that is actually patentable? So another way you can look at software is if you did it before without a computer, just because you do it with a computer, it doesn't make it a patentable invention. There always has to be another step that the computer does, measure pressures in I think this was one case that was like measuring pressures in a tire manufacturer, the pressure in the tire. In the rubber for the purposes of, you know, is the tire cured properly? So there's actually a physical manifestation of what the computer program has done. So it's software is getting harder and harder to patent. So if anybody has any questions on software, they can come back to me. Okay, safeguarding intellectual property is key. So EPA staff, contractors, and grantees have a duty to protect intellectual property from premature disclosure. And intellectual property here means patents. Don't discuss your ideas without a non-disclosure agreement in place. Do not publish or present without a filed patent application, not issued, but a filing. You need a filing date. Do not transfer this information without the property authority and tech transfer vehicle. Sarah went through those, CRADAs, MTAs, MCRADAs. You know, she went through that laundry list for you folks. And do not disclose someone else's work, even by accident. Okay, next slide. Okay, so what is premature disclosure? Premature disclosure, prior to taking necessary steps to protect the IP, such as filing a patent application or signing an NDA, premature disclosures can be presentations, papers and publishing. If the invention will be patented, you must file a patent application before you publish, please. Casual discussions, you know, at symposiums or, you know, after work, social events outside the office, or even demonstrating the technology in the public domain prior to patent application protection. These all constitute premature disclosures if done before a patent application is filed. And the problem with the okay, is that the next slide? Yeah, consequences. Okay. So first, I'm going to, and the reason this is so important is exacerbated by the American Invents Act first inventor to file system, which went into law March 13, 2013. And what that is our system used to be first to invent. So if a patent application is filed and you show, well, I invented it first, not this person who filed, then the invention would belong to you. Now the system is first inventor to file, which is kind of a hybrid between first to file and first to invent. So it's a little more complicated, but the thing is that somebody who files ahead of you can defeat your rights in something that you've created. So if you have any questions on that, I'd be happy to address those as well. Heather, if you want to stop me at some point for the purpose of questions, just let me know, okay?
Okay, sure. There was a question. What type of inventions does EPA tend to find most worthwhile to patent? And secondary to that is there a reason to patent a method, such as a method for measuring exposure, toxicity, et cetera?
The answer to the first one was again. What was the first one?
What types of inventions does EPA tend to find most worthwhile to patent?
We have patents in the area of microbiology. Black mold detection is big. We also have technologies that can identify the source of E. coli, as in species specific. Be it a human, a cow, a chicken. We're developing those kind of microbial inventions. We also have done a lot of work in like air samplers, different types of inlets that can split the airstream into different sizes, multiple parameter detection systems like the ZAPS invention that Sarah had described before. They're geared towards environmental improvement, environmental monitoring, environmental cleanup. Those are the areas that that EPA patents in, because those are all in accordance with our mission. We've also patented techniques for we identified one of the male infertility genes further developed under a CRADA. So yeah, it's kind of broad. I mean, you know, it's kind of broad. I mean, we don't have the same kind of patents that DOD or NASA or even DOE have, but, you know, ours are geared towards our mission. And what was the second question?
Thanks for that answer. The second question was, is there a reason to patent a method, such as a method for measuring exposure, toxicity, et cetera?
Oh, sure, yeah. We patented a method for detecting E. coli, and we lots of times patents are either method patents or apparatus patents or both. Sometimes you have an apparatus and you have a method for operating that apparatus, and that'll translate into two patents. So we do methods all the time. We had a method for detecting both E. coli and total coliforms in the same media, which is hugely popular and heavily licensed. So yeah, we patent methods as well as apparatus.
Thanks. Okay. If you'd like to continue, I will encourage people to continue to submit their questions. At this time, there's no unanswered questions.
Okay, great. Okay, back to premature disclosure. The consequences of premature disclosure can be pretty harsh. Automatically, you lose your ability to file in a foreign country. Only the U.S. allows a one-year grace period before filing a patent application. But you have to do it, you know, within 365 days of that disclosure, or you are precluded from a U.S. patent as well. Other consequences can be government property, such as EPA's technology being shared without the proper permission or authority, those that Sarah has gone over already, potential to hinder EPA's ability to perform its mission because we do not, you know, because we have lost our technology, you know, because we have lost our rights to our technology. So premature disclosure can be fairly harsh. Is testing or demonstrating a disclosure? And the answer to that is it depends. But I caution, do not do so until you either talk to your institution's counsel or FDTA staff, if you're doing it on behalf of EPA, to discuss what's disclosed and what the next steps are. Or even better, if you're anticipating a disclosure, a demonstration or whatever, please contact your folks beforehand and they will guide you. You know, I mean, even poster sessions can be a disclosure if they enable the invention. In other words, if the description is enough that somebody who's skilled in the art, in other words, who knows the technology, with moderate experimentation can recreate that which is disclosed, then it's a disclosure. And then the U.S. clock starts for the one-year clock starts for a U.S. application.
And Sarah, you had provided examples, right, of what in the previous slide you had provided examples of what a premature disclosure would be. Is that? Can we look at that one more time?
No, Sarah didn't. What is premature? The laundry list here: presentations, papers, publishing, even discussions, demonstrating in the public domain. I mean, you know, this doesn't include stuff that's considered development, as in, you know, a peer review or your colleagues. You know, are you putting it out there in the public in some way? And a published paper, you know, even if it's for the smallest journal, and five people read it, it's still a disclosure.
Okay, that was a follow-up question that had come in, so I thought maybe you could, yeah, that's perfect. Thank you.
This is Sarah. I can give an amusing example. It's one that our other patent attorney, Randall, likes to use, and that's the whalebone for a stay in a woman's corset, where the inventor actually put it into a corset and wanted his wife to model it, to wear it, to see if it was comfortable. And so she wore it around for the day, and that was that was a disclosure because it was actually outside of the house. and out in the general public at the time. So it's just
And that is an actual case that is the basis for the case law on premature disclosure, believe it or not.
But even having a casual conversation at a cocktail party with your neighbor, and even if they don't know what you do at work, if you talk about it outside of that, of your work environment, to a friend at a cocktail party is a disclosure.
Okay. And was that clear for whoever asked that? Is that clear enough?
I believe so. We can. That person can resubmit another question if that didn't satisfy. So,
sure.
Thanks, Laura.
Okay. Okay. All right. Oh, yeah. Here are the authorities for tech transfer and ownership of inventions. Bayh-Dole is especially important to contractors and grantees who receive government funds because I'll get into who owns the patenting rights, but Bayh-Dole Act started all that, the Federal Technology Transfer Act, with following delegations and royalty guidelines. And yeah, this slide is all of the authorities involved with tech transfer. Okay, now who owns the patent rights? Okay, so if an EPA employee invents in the course of his or her duties, uses EPA facilities and or resources, then the federal government obtains title to the invention from the inventor. You see, patent applications are filed in the name of the inventor, not the company they worked for, like they do in other parts of the world. In the U.S., they're filed in the name of the inventor, and often the inventor has an employment obligation to assign to their employer, such as government employees using government facilities, funds, and it's as part of their job. Contractors who invent under government contracts, funded by the government, they keep their patent rights. However, they are subject to something. They keep their patent rights. In return, though, the government keeps a statutory minimum license to use for governmental purposes. That's the standard minimum rights license. It's free. It just attaches to the government because the government provided the funds. There is an exception, though, for contractors who the DOD uses this more than us, but if the government finds that exceptional circumstances and can compel the contractor to assign or license a technology if it's in the interest of tech transfer. The contractor doesn't give it up for free. They assign or license the technology for a fair royalty, or for a fair one-time price. So they don't do it for free, but they can be compelled to do it if the government sees a need to do it under the exceptional circumstances. Now, for grantees, it's the same rights as the contractors, where the government retains their minimum rights. That's also under Bayh-Dole. Grantees, they have to report through something called iEdison, contractors as well, which is a nationwide database for inventions made with federal funds where the recipient has invented, and they have to report the invention back to the government so the government knows it has the license, the minimum license. So that's called iEdison, small I, capital E, Edison. There is an exemption for grantees, though, as far as the minimum government minimum rights, and that if it's a 212 grant, an educational grant, then the grantee retains all the rights. There is no government minimum license. So it's important to know whether or not you are a grantee under 202 or if you're a grantee under Section 212. Okay, and if there's a co-invention between EPA and a non-EPA co-inventor, then each party retains the rights that I previously went through. Now, let me stop here and see if anybody has any questions regarding all that.
Yes, Laura, we did get a couple of questions. Does disclosure of the general principles of a device in a research proposal to an IEHS or any other federal granting system, would that constitute disclosure?
Oh, boy. That's a really good question. Okay, yeah, because, you know, you're disclosing it to an agent, you know, agency or entity who you're hoping will fund your idea. Gee whiz.
And I guess also, would that be disclosure? I mean, there's also the premature disclosure, but...
Right. Well...
They specifically asked about disclosure.
Right. I guess a grants person has to tell them. I guess I would have to get with somebody in grants, because do they keep these applications, these research proposals, these applications for funding confidential? I know contract does.
Right.
Do grantees do?
During a review process, the grant reviewer would need to sign an agreement that says they're not going to talk about intellectual property. So it is kept private in that sense. But, you know, the idea does remain in, you know, someone else has read it. They know about it. They're just under an agreement to not say anything about intellectual property.
Right. Well, if an NDA is in place, then that kind of shields you. Although NDAs can go wrong, people can still blab, in which case then that constitutes the disclosure. So, Jeff, were you going to say something, or was somebody going to say something?
I was just going to put another spin on this one, which would be, so we have NIHS grantees who are providing progress summaries to NIEHS, and I presume that would not be disclosure.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. And we got another comment from someone who used to work in the tech transfer office, and they were told that submissions to grant agencies does not constitute disclosure.
Okay, good.
And that's my understanding as well. But that's definitely a good question, isn't it? And
sure is. I learned something.
Yeah.
So,
and then
when
you're talking about grantees, just to clarify, you know, on slide 38, that's EPA grantee and IEHS grantee. These are not specific to EPA grantees.
Federal grantees, minimum funding. Pardon?
And then question, how often or how common is it that minimum license period that the government picks it up? Because, you know, from the perspective of an inventor, you know, that almost means there's an opportunity to have your great idea kind of scooped up. So how often does that happen?
The minimum license is for the government to use for governmental purposes. It is not a commercial taking. It's to use for governmental purposes, which is kind of broad, but does not, you know, entail royalties or anything like that. You know, it's not a commercial use that the government is interested in. It's a use for further research, or if it's something, you know, that is, you know, it's data, the government can use the data, you know, that sort of thing. So does that answer the question, or was there more to the question?
Oh, just how common does that happen, where that licensing happens during that that statute?
Oh, it's automatic, and it's for the life of the patent.
Okay.
Yeah, it's automatic, and it's for the life of the patent. But the grantee retains all the other rights, the commercial rights. so they can, you know, so that they can exclusively license subject to, and the license would have to say subject to the government's statutory minimum license to use for governmental purposes, or in those words. So, yeah, but as far as commercializing and all that, yeah, then the grantee keeps all those.
Great, thank you. And that's all the questions we have right at this time.
Okay, great. Good questions. All right, I'll keep going. Okay, so EPA does patent its inventions, and they license their inventions. Licensing, I think everybody knows what a license is, but it's a transfer of the property rights in an invention in a government-owned, for at least as far as EPA is concerned, in a government-owned invention. Licenses can be associated with a patent that was the outcome of a CRADA. That's one of the few authorities where we can automatically or almost automatically grant an exclusive license to a CRADA cooperator so that the cooperator can have the bundle of rights to go commercialize and to commercialize the technology. If it's our own technology, then we usually issue a non-exclusive license. Occasionally, we'll do an exclusive license if we can justify it. In other words, if the licensee has to expend a lot of its own resources to further develop or commercialize the technology for the market, we can often justify an exclusive license there. But typically, our inventions are licensed non-exclusively, and these are government-owned inventions. Sarah's group starts the licenses, and they're negotiated by Sarah's group, and sometimes we help. Of course, the inventor's laboratory management. They all take part in negotiating the terms for a license. Because these are commercial licenses. Sometimes we do research licenses, but those aren't nearly as frequent. And this last bullet pretty much doesn't apply to you, so we'll just skip it. U.S. patent applications typically cost, depending on the technology. Our technologies aren't nearly as complex as other technologies like you would see in DOD or DOE. Our technologies, we can typically patent in the $10,000 to $15,000 range for a U.S. patent. Foreign patent filings can be very expensive depending on the country or the region. Europe, the European Patent Office is very expensive. Canada is about the same as us. Mexico is a little cheaper than us. The Pacific Rim, Japan, Korea, also very expensive. And these are expensive to maintain because just about every country has an annuity where while the patent application is being examined all the way through getting the patent allowed and getting the patent number issued, there's an annual fee for all of that, and that in itself can put your application, like say in Europe, in the $50,000 to $100,000 range. The U.S., once the patent issues, there's a maintenance fee every 4 years, to the tune of $2,000, then $4,000, then $7,000. So there's usually three maintenance fees due once the patent issues. The term of a U.S. patent is 20 years from the date of application. So that is how long your patent would be in effect should it issue. Okay. Slide. Okay, why isn't my slide advancing? There we go. Okay. So here's a little schematic that shows you the patenting process. Eureka, you have an idea. Make sure you record it in a physical notebook, paper notebook, computer notebook, where things can't get altered. You have to show that you invented and the date that you know, and the dates involved with your invention. So make sure you keep your notebook. For EPA employees anyway, they prepare a report of invention and provide it to their laboratory management. We do, EPA does a patentability opinion. For grantees, you go from your recorded in the notebook to your patent application. It gets examined at the patent office, and it can take up to 3 years for the from filing date for the examiner to pick it up. That's being shortened closer to 2 years, takes a year, you know, so you're looking at a good 3 year period between by the time you file and by the time your patent gets allowed, if it is able to get allowed. And that's what the examination will determine, whether or not it's an allowable it's allowable subject matter. Okay, and that's the end of my presentation. So do we have any more questions on intellectual property, patenting, or licensing, and anything in those areas that I can answer for you now?
No additional questions have come through.
Okay, great.
So this is Jeff Heimerman. I am wondering, and I haven't cleared this ahead of time, but what would be the chances at this point in time, since the formal presentation is over, to open the phone lines and try and manage the questions that come in and see what kind of verbal exchange there might be out there?
That's fine with me. Is that okay with Sarah Mishmandani?
Sure.
Yep, it should be just fine. Kevin, are you on the line? Let me get Kevin really quick because he is hosting, and I'll just need to get him to open the phone lines. So I'll do that in 2 seconds.
Sounds good. Thanks, Sarah. And I guess that also means that if any folks are in allowed room, they might want to put their phone on mute manually, because Sarah is going to be unmuting the lines, and that'll give the opportunity for a little more open discussion. Certainly among our attendee list are people who are very, very accustomed, very familiar with some of these processes, including the patent process. I'm not aware of any CRADA arrangements or any other formal FTTA among our grantees, but would certainly be interested in learning about that.
So my suggestion is, once this globally is unmuted, that keep your phone muted unless you do have a question or an interjection. And hopefully that happens soon. Bear with us.
This is Sarah Bauer. Can I just briefly show what's at the end of this so that people, if they have to log off early, know we have on the presentation, there we go, all of our contact information. And then we have the links. These are the FTTA and Federal Lab Consortium links that I refer to, and then the links to the research program offices, and laboratories are all at the end of the presentation. So I just wanted you to see what was at the end.
Hi, this is Kevin.
Sarah.
Hi, this is Kevin. I've been asked to unmute everyone's line, so I just want to confirm you all want me to do that?
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so everyone on the line, I'm going to unmute your lines. If you are on a phone and you don't have a question to ask, please mute your own phone line. Thank you very much. Here we go.
While people are getting a chance to mute their own phone lines with extra voice in the background, I just want to let you know that this event has been recorded, and we're going to put it on
A call and add a few more schools, another local school, but the other being in California.
Hi, I just muted everyone again. I think there are some people who are probably not paying attention, so they don't know that they might be talking on another line and such. So. not sure how to move forward. I don't think unmuting everyone would be a good idea, but I can try that again if you'd like. Oh, I'm sorry. I did end up muting everybody. So panelists, you would have to unmute your own lines if you'd like to respond.
Hi, Kevin. This is Laura. I thought that was kind of horrendous when you tried to tie in all those 40-odd lines. So I think maybe it's just easier if folks, you know, do the little raised hand thing or type in, you know, question and answers.
I agree.
Okay.
We do have a question from a Jennifer Guelfo. I will unmute her line and see if she can communicate with us. Hold on a second.
Okay, great.
Hi, Jennifer. Are you there?
I'm here, but I think maybe I hit the hand when I was trying to mute myself earlier. Sorry.
Okay, I'll go ahead and mute you again. Thank you.
Kevin, would you please unmute call-in user 5? That's Heather. I think you had her muted as well.
Yes, sure thing. Hold on a second.
Okay, sounds like I've been unmuted.
Yep, you're here now.
Okay, thanks. So a question came in, could you talk a bit more about the licensing process and how potential licensees are found? Does the EPA have preferred corporate partners, or is the institution responsible for finding licensees on a new technology?
Sarah, do you want to take this one, or should I?
Sure. I can start, and then you can add to it. I think that what we try to do for CRADAs specifically, for the CRADAs and the MCRADAs and the MTAs under the Act, it says that we should try to provide opportunity first to small and medium-sized businesses, but that does not preclude us from, you know, working with companies of all sizes and international companies as well. In the case of licensing, I think it could be the same as well. We have licensees who are small entities versus international major organizations. We have in the past had the ability to do a market analysis on our technologies, which would provide some market information on who appropriate licensees would be and if the market's ready. We do not have the capability to perform those anymore, so we rely a lot of times on the expertise of the lab. But mostly we find that the scientists working with their colleagues in the area through word of mouth and through presentations, et cetera, the folks in that specific area of research find out about the technology and contact us to potentially license it. We also have our patents posted on our website. So that's the base of what we do for licensing. Laura, do you want to add anything to that?
No, that pretty much covers it, how we find our licensees and creative partners. Lots of times our inventors are keyed into the technology and the business associated with the technology. They know who's doing what and where. So some of our collaborations just come from our own people. Okay, was there another question?
Not yet. And in the meantime, I did want to just make sure everybody heard. I tried to make the announcement when we went unmuted, and I'm not sure if anybody heard, but we will be posting an archive of this on CLUIN, and we'll link to it from the SRP website, and we'll include it in our newsletter. And we definitely encourage you to send this on and to other folks who might be interested in hearing about the federal transfer technology transfer agreements. The other thing is that the organizers had requested that what we were planning to do is send an email to all who registered and get an idea of how many participants you had on the line with you so we can get an overall attendance number, and then also give you an opportunity to provide feedback and evaluation of today's call. So we certainly hope that it was a useful way to use your time, and we certainly appreciate our EPA colleagues who, you know, they do these types of calls quite a bit for the EPA staff, is my understanding. And so this is the first time they've done this for grantees, and I think it's been a very valuable experience to learn from your side, EPA, how you can work through some of these formal agreements. We're still not seeing any questions coming in, and unless maybe for some reason I'm disconnected to the question panel.
This is Jeff. Nope. I do have a question for the panel, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Can you, so make Sarah, make believe I'm one of the grantees. How do you guys provide any help to me, given the specific research that I'm engaged in, find appropriate EPA researchers to discuss the opportunity? Does your office help with that?
Yes. What we would do is, once you contact us and give us an idea of what it is you're interested in doing, we will reach out to our labs and ask if there's anyone that could either get back to us or get back to you to let you know what the possibilities are. The only tricky part of this is that the lab, of course, it has to be within the mission of the laboratory, and it has to be something that falls under their research plan that they have the resources to do, meaning they have a scientist who has the time to dedicate to doing a collaborative agreement. But we're kind of your first-stop shop. So if you look at the contact information at the end of the presentation, just give us a call and talk about what it is you want to do, and we'll see if we can find a match. We can also ask some of our scientists to have a chat with you to, you know, discuss maybe a little broader perspective of the research that needs to be done, or perhaps refer on to colleagues at other federal agencies. And that's where the Federal Lab Consortium can come in handy, that if you do have a specific area of expertise or research that you're focusing on, you can plug that into the locator and look at what other agencies are doing in that field.
And in a follow-up question, you've talked about facility user agreements. Is there, EPA have any plans to make public, particular locations with particularly unique equipment? I'm thinking things like wind tunnels or some super GCMS.
The user facilities is, the reason it falls under FTTA is because it was supposedly done for research purposes, and it was our research laboratories that were being used. And so we were the first stop shop for that. But we really, as soon as we get that, we pass it off to the laboratories, because they manage not only the, you know, administrative side, can they rent it out, what's it going to cost, what are the requirements to do that, but also what they would have available. And a lot of times that changed. I know one of our labs used to open up their lab for use, but changed with security issues, with Homeland Security issues, and they no longer wanted to have the vulnerability associated with opening up their lab. So am not sure. It's something we can check on to see if that's going to be updated. We don't get very many calls for user facilities at all. Usually the user facility requests that come in, I'm assuming, probably come in through the research scientist colleagues out in the private sector wanting to use something that they're using, and so they would contact the lab directly without contacting us. But again, we can certainly refer you to the appropriate person. And if you're interested in a potential piece of equipment that you think the lab might have, you can always ask and we can see if something like that is available.
Thank you. That was very good to know. It's good information to know. So certainly, and we have your contact information up there. It sounds as though contacting you all is a good first step to getting connected to some of these opportunities. We still have a bit of time left. However, we don't have any more questions that have come in. So I think since we do have your contact information and the folks who are on the call know that they can contact you with their first line of questions about getting connected, why don't we go ahead and thank our presenters for giving a very informative overview of the FTTA and the process therein. Again, that was Sarah Bauer and Laura Scalise, and we also heard from Jeff Heimerman, and certainly wanted to thank them for their organization and coordination of this webinar, as well as Kathleen Graham, who also contributed. A lot of folks from the SRP office also helped coordinate this call, and want to thank them for their help, and especially to Kevin and Sarah, who helped behind the scenes with our WebEx event. So at this point, again, thank you very much for tuning in. This concludes today's webinar, and thank you for participating, and please look for that participation email that we'll be sending as a follow-up. Thanks very much, and have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Heather. Okay.